Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark.
Stories from the Other Side of Midnight, Volume 5, Story Number 1. This is something from my early days driving. At the time, I had a Lincoln Mark 7 LSE. Fast car. You'd accelerate, and the car would suck down to the road. It was so aerodynamic and heavy for its size. Not a glorified T-Bird, as some try to claim. I was about 19, been driving for about a year. I was on my way home from visiting my parents. It was just after dark on a Sunday evening, so there was not a lot of traffic, even though I wasn't a major thoroughfare. I was on Beltway 8. Approaching 59 to go north, when this older guy, probably in his 50s, driving an old piece of shit Bonneville, pulls up beside me on the driver's side and starts steering his car so it almost hits mine, like swooping over close to mine within inches, then pulling back into his lane and then almost hitting me again. He did it several times, all the while laughing like a lunatic and looking right at me. I'll never forget his face. I guarantee I could pick him out of a lineup even now. After several attempts to ram me, I started thinking he was trying to run me off the road for some reason. There's a curved ramp that goes from the Beltway onto the access road of 59 North, 2 lanes wide at the time. I don't know if it still is or not. I was in the right lane, he was in the left. At the time, there was, and still is, a deep pond to the left of the ramp, a sort of water collection area for rain runoff. I was scared by that point and decided it was either going to be him or me, and I knew it wasn't going to be me. I knew if I didn't take some action, something bad was going to happen to me. I said, "Help me, Lord," and guided my car into his. Not slammed, not hit, just guided my car into his and turned the wheel left and put the power to the pedal and ran him up over the curb. I pulled right again and stayed on the ramp. But I saw his car go flying through the grass and into the water, and it went under. As I was continuing around the ramp, I could see the taillights in my rearview mirror under the water. I kept going. I didn't start shaking until a couple of minutes later, when my husband saw the car all pushed in on the driver's side. He was mad. When I told him what I did and why, he was quite proud of me. Of course, the car had to have new body panels, lamps, and turn signals on that side, etc. But he sold it and got me another Mark 7 LSE. Different color. I'll never forget the way that guy was laughing. It was just pure evil. Next story. I was just out of high school and got my scuba license earlier that spring. Went with a couple of friends to the local rock quarries whenever the time allowed and got to dive all day. Several times we dove well into the night, just relying on the moon sometimes. With spring water seeping up through the limestone, water temps were usually down to 53 degrees at the bottom. I remember there being two very distinct thermoclines while descending to the bottom. Required a wetsuit, at least a shorty if you were to brave it, and to burden the cold water temp. The depth was just about 60 feet, but without gloves my hands would feel like they were burning. The cold around my head seemed so intense that caused a major headache to the point of exploding, if not wearing a hood. Well, one night I was returning from the other side of a particular quarry by myself. Only from the moonlight was I able to see anything. The water was crystal clear, and at just above the bottom, I could barely make out a few plants and small fish. There were some alligator snapping turtles here, but usually went the other way when approached. They are very dark-looking, so easily identifiable when moving. As I was about one-third the way across, something made my heart rate increase, and then my breathing went into overdrive. A large, lightly colored mass swam right under me. It was bigger than any turtle or fish I had ever seen in any quarry, and the general shape was of neither. When directly under me, I felt a tingling sensation all over my exposed legs, and the water swept up was colder than I had ever felt there before. It was stirring up the silt from the bottom, too. Needless to say, I went into high gear to get the F out of that spot and to the other side of the quarry. When When I finally made it across, the night was darker than usual and eerily quiet. A light fog had already started to set in, which was very unusual this time of year. I looked down and my legs were all splayed with a very painful-looking rash. The surface of my skin was slightly numb and feeling stiff, like partially paralyzed. It was hard for me to get out of my gear and load everything up. I realized it was difficult for me to walk and get in the truck. I managed to make it home about an hour's drive away, though I don't really remember much on the drive back. I felt a little cold and sweating slightly, but noticed my legs were not as in bad of a shape when I left. Made it home and was not feeling up to anything but going to bed. Definitely a little dizzy and my head was pounding by now. Took a handful of aspirin and hit the sack. The sleep took me almost immediately. The next day I woke up very late in the afternoon after some memories of some very vivid dreams. Almost psychotic. I was completely drained of any strength and my bed was very wet. Seemed like I had sweat most of the night. My throat was extremely parched and dry. I stood up and looked in the mirror to see myself drained of any color and hair looked like a very old and used up mop. Fortunately, I didn't feel as bad like the night before. Through the day, my senses mellowed out and everything went back to normal. Well, almost everything. That rashy area on my exposed legs took forever to go away. Originally looked just like a heat rash, but kept getting darker red. Even though the pain went away fairly quickly, the rash turned to deep scabs. They went from light red to almost black and finally went and disappeared. There's scarring all over the worst parts. Looks very similar to a bad case of acne on someone's face. To this day, the worst spots are still hypersensitive. I was definitely a few pounds lighter from that very intense and deliberate sleep too. That was the last solo dive I did at night in a quarry. And this is another story about diving. An elder of the church I attended growing up knew I was seriously into scuba diving. He always inquired about how things were going. One day I mentioned to him about finishing up my advanced open water and search and rescue classes. He seemed impressed and asked me if I had any inclination to use my newfound skill set. He was a full-time fireman in the city and also a volunteer in a small town he lived in. They occasionally did search and rescue recovery at some of the area lakes. He asked if I would be interested the next time he was called out. I said sure. Sounded like a good way to get some real-world experience. Well, that day came soon enough. He called and told me there had been a possible drowning and the two girls had not been located yet. Well, like an idiot, I agreed to help out. Went to the lake, and there were a few divers there already. Phil, my fireman friend, hooked me up with another diver and we discussed the usual routine to search. This time we used a rope where diver would hold it at one location and the other diver would circle around and bring the rope up shorter with each pass until a stationary diver was reached. This went without issue for most of the morning. Even the most lakes had zero visibility. Once you were more than 2 feet down and used to this, I still always felt less than comfortable. The depths we were searching rarely got more than 20 feet down, but with no visibility, it really didn't matter how deep you were. The sun didn't leave you any idea it was shining, even in early afternoon. Occasionally, the rope would snag up on something and then I would have to check it out. Swim over in a straight line pulling the rope until I found the problem. Well, that was a norm to proceed, until the last time I went out to search. Going through the routine of circling round, the rope caught and snagged up. I pulled at it a few times and did not get a direct response from the other diver, only a very slight pull. So I swam toward the hang-up. It went down a little deeper, and water got noticeably colder as the depth increased. That was totally normal in a murky lake, and was still not too cold to be uncomfortable. In dirty water, the thermoclines come much closer together. Every couple of feet, it would change very noticeably. It did get cold enough that I was starting to chill, but went to find a snag. As I dropped down to the bottom, my flippers and fins sunk into a couple feet of silt. This is usually water muddied up very much, but not so heavy that it sank and settled down. I found what was thought to be the problem with the rope. It was tangled up in a tree stump. When the tree stumps are submerged for years in water, the dirt around usually washes away, exposing the roots that are left completely intact. The wood also gets extremely hard and next to impossible to break or even cut with a saw. It's also very slippery and slimy through the green underwater growth. There was a noticeable but ever so slight current I could feel moving past me. That's what I thought was causing a light tug on the rope. So I felt around to free the rope, and my arms were going between some of the exposed roots. But when I got in a tight spot, something happened I was not or ever will be prepared for. It felt just like something grabbed my arm. Not just once, but kept trying over and over. Now, it didn't take me but a second to have that total freak out, driving me crazy, and I dropped the rope and tried to swim up and away. But standing in that silt, I had sunk down nearly 2 feet and could not get any more momentum to head for the surface. I started pushing away and kicking. When I broke free and finally started to ascend, again there was something trying to grab at my legs. This really put me into high gear to get the heck out of there. Usually, when something freaks you out underwater, you will drain the tank dry very quickly. I have been very good to pace my breathing even when I got spooked, but this time was just a little different. As I broke free from the tree trunk and heavily taking a huge breath in, the regulator was pulled out of my mouth. Not good. All of that suction on regulator that was now spewing air out everywhere but in my mouth caused a massive intake of dirty lake water into my mouth. This just made it worse. Out of breath, full of water, and nowhere but up to get out of there. And up was not happening. As I was nearly panicking to swim up to the surface and coughing with my lungs feeling like they were full of water, was not getting very far. Without lungs full of air, your body is buoyant, so you don't go up as fast as your fins are pushing. So I immediately grabbed for the emergency inflation string from my buoyancy compensator. This filled up and I shot to the surface. My head popped out above a good 2 feet and was very quickly noticed by those around in the search operation. It is not uncommon for rookies looking for dead bodies to panic and get the heck out of there if they find something thought to be a corpse. I never thought about it until later and glad I had not. There's something very unnerving about grabbing at a dead body underwater in total darkness. It has a feel that is unmistakable. You will know what it is when it happens. That fear mixed with the sensation of fear I was now experiencing would have taken me over the top. I did not want to be the next victim in need of search and rescue. Since I was coughing up my lungs, a boat immediately headed my way and pulled me out. They got me calmed down a little by the time we reached the shore. My fireman friend Phil was not panicked. If something had happened to me, he rushed over there lightning fast and profusely apologized for getting me in any danger. By now, I was able to breathe a little better, but still coughing very hard when trying to talk. About 30 minutes had elapsed and finally was able to get a few words out. I drank down a good half gallon of water by now and breathing somewhat shallow but more regular. Phil was still in a panic, so I motioned for him to come over. I had no intention to tell him what I thought had just actually taken place, but did explain that I must have gotten tangled up in an old tree trunk and regulator got knocked out of my mouth when trying to free up the rope. Then, something else took place I will never forget. There were two other divers in that same spot earlier. Since I had made a scene, a few dropped down to continue the search. They had ascended to the surface, screaming and yelling. Both went to shore stripped out of the gear that was supplied to them. They were shaking their heads at each other and swearing never to dive again. They were making so much commotion, it took away from the attention that was focused on me for the last hour. I was somewhat glad for the now attention directed towards something other than myself. But these older guys were acting just raving mad. They would not talk to anyone. Both of them just got in their cars and left. I found out later there were also some of the volunteers that showed up like I did. Well, things calmed down a little and Phil came back over to me with a puzzled look on his face. He was looking me over and asking about all the marks on my arms and legs. I never bothered to look myself over after getting back to shore. Both my legs and one arm had been scratched and streaked full of bruises. There were 3 thin bruise streaks down my arm and legs that started from bloody torn flesh to deep scratches, then blended to bruising. It did not look serious as it might sound, not much different than what you'd expect falling from the top of a tree, except for the long streaks of bruising. The rest of the visible damage looked fairly common in younger years doing stupid things. Once I remembered vividly to this day, I used to ride my bike down the street fast as I could pedal, then crash into an evergreen bush. I would get thrown off and slam through and landing on the other side. No major damage, except for all the scrapes and scratches that would be incurred during such an exhibition of stupidity. But that was just some of the fun growing up. What was odd is the three lines of scratches and bruising on one side had a single matching one around the other side of the arm and legs. No scratches with a single mark, but bruising was a little darker and wider. I just brushed it all off as really getting tangled up in stump roots. Now, the other diver's attention was where all of the commotion had been focused around for the last hour and a half. The experienced professional ones went down as a group of four together. It wasn't long before a balloon popped up on the surface. That was a sign a body had been found. This just sent cold chills down my spine. I've been over 24 hours since the drowning and usually takes 2 or 3 days before they bloat and come to the surface. I can swear what actually happened down there, but know something, not being roots, had made contact with me. I didn't want to think about it anymore. Since Phil was just a volunteer for this particular recovery, and now that the bodies had actually been located, we left everything to a small group of professional divers to recover the bodies. Our job was just assisting in locating. The actual recovery had to be made by the ones on the search and rescue team, or recovery in this case. It was a few days later that Phil stopped by to follow up with me. He wanted to find out if I was doing okay and asked if there was anything else I may have remembered from my dive. He also had a newspaper article covering the recovery. It had listed the incident and thanked all the volunteers that offered their help. It went into detail of how the bodies were swept down and trapped in exposed roots under a tree stump. They had been dead for over 24 hours from the coroner's report. It was also assumed they were possibly alive when initially trapped, as there was broken fingernails and were severely scraped nearly to the bone of their fingertips. They also said the bodies would likely never been located. The girl's arm had not been wrapped up in that search rope. Phil looked straight into my eyes. He asked again what happened down there. I told him that my legs got stuck in the silt and then knocked off my regulator. I looked down at the ground while answering his question. I never mentioned my mouthpiece was torn off either. Trying to deflect that moment, I asked, whatever happened to the other guys that had left? He said they had not been seen or heard from since. He did not know who they were, but it was not that uncommon for volunteers to freak out sometimes, especially ones that had not been in a recovery situation before. Well, I definitely got that hands-on experience that day. Enough to last a lifetime. Next story. Well, a customer had become a friend recently and asked if I was interested in making some easy money. Nowadays, that would get an immediate response of no. Not just no, but hell no. But in the younger years of adventure, I had to go ahead and listen and didn't say no. He assured me it was an easy job and no big deal. He worked for some waterworks company. I would have an opportunity to go do some scuba diving and get paid for it. So how bad could it be, right? Okay, I'm listening. Go on. He needed to find a diver to check out a water intake to some power plant at a lake not too far away. So all I needed to do was unlock a grate at the opening of a 36-inch diameter concrete wall intake, then swim up to find out if there was any restriction through the length of pipe. This was an inspection that was required before the intake could be used. He said it was a yearly thing and the usual diver was not available. It also paid $300. At that time in my life, this was a heck of a lot of money, even for a full day's work. So the weekend for my exploration came around. I checked over all of my equipment before proceeding to get all wet. A little apprehensive but determined to not chicken out. Now that I'm geared up and stood knee deep in water with my regulator in my mouth, I was starting to get cold feet and I turned around and I remembered that I needed the key and he gave him to me and I thanked him and then I stopped. That was not really the reason I turned around. So now I'm stuck with going through the dive. Biting down on the mouthpiece to help control the need to kick myself in the you-know-where, I felt it partially tear apart. Not the first time I'm stuck and headed out to find that entry. Fortunately, this particular lake is very clear. Clean water that tastes like Ozark spring water. Well, it used to many several years ago. Now probably not so much. So I was descending down to the location of that concrete pipe with a grate that is locked. The area I'm diving in has warning signs all over the place, like you see at many aerial lakes that are fenced off, warning about the spillway and any dangerous areas you are not supposed to cross into. No sooner as I approach the bottom, there are warning signs everywhere and markers leading the way to that intake opening. So, uneventful as this descent was, it was just unlocking the grate and swinging open out of the way, right? I'm down there and I'm committed and stuck with following through with the task at hand. I had a small hand pick, just in case. Just in case for what? I don't know. With my trusty flashlight, I proceeded down the big Mongo pipe and slowly swam deeper into the dark abyss. The underwater lights at this time in history were nothing more than a 6-volt lantern flashlight in a waterproof case. Some of the fancier ones even had rechargeable batteries. Wow, talk about high tech. So headed up the pipe, down the pipe, just deeper through the pipe. Really hard to tell when it's pitch black and bouncing your tank off the concrete. I can just barely see 3 feet in front of me before it turned completely dark. It's kind of like using fog lights late at night in heavy fog. It's bright directly in front of you, but the light really seems to just reflect back in your face. Can't see anything but a blur into nothing. What seemed to be around 100 feet up this pipe, I started to find all kinds of sticks woven together and what could be packed in mud between all of it. I thought this was very strange, especially this far up. I figured this deep past the entrance would be smooth sailing to that T close to the power plant. So I got the heck out of there and I could get that easy money. Yeah, so far, no good. Nothing ever is easy as someone else tries to explain it, especially if they've never done it themselves. Yeah, just swam up this hole and pick up your check. Keep telling yourself that, over and over again. Maybe there will be a light at the end of this tunnel. Or what else? I kept trudging along slowly enough, not to stir up any more silt than already had. But too late, next to impossible to see anything, so I stopped and tried to keep myself calm. I checked over the gauges. Okay, seemed I was about 75 feet down and only used a few hundred pounds of air so far. I looked at the time, and not much has really passed. Seems to be an eternity, though. Still have plenty of time to deal with a short decompression before completely surfacing. Something I don't need to think about right now. Now, it's time to keep heading up the line to make my way to freedom. As I kept going, the sticks kept getting more dense and really don't look like something that's been sucked in or settled from the current. I didn't get it and started to feel that nervous feeling that something is not as it seems. Okay. Too many old scary movies to think about right now. I don't need to be the star of another one. Keep going, just keep going. About another 20 feet or so, what seems as something at the beginning of a horror movie. I start getting struck over and over again with something, or things are going past me extremely fast, over and over again, hitting nonstop the full length of my body. Slapping and scraping my arms and legs, things of stabbing pains are shooting on every exposed part of my skin. Not enough to be seriously in fear for my life, just enough to be concerned. Completely shitless. It all happened way too fast for me to even think about anything. But what the heck was this? It's not like I could easily turn myself around and swim back out the way that I was now headed. Not enough room to do anything but back out by hand a lot slower than I could continue forward. No sooner than all of these unknown origin were scurrying past me, everything went calm again. Whatever just swam past, which they were very slender, with felt like long tails and short legs and feet in varying sizes, finally were all gone. I always kept my wits about me in most situations, at least until it's way past over the initial scare, before my heart started racing and breathing turned into a tsunami. It was definitely one of those times, and no need to hold back, except I had nowhere to go but continued forward to the escape hatch. I was now referring to the tee near the power plant. Hopefully, they had that part open so I could make a daring leap out of this fish tank into my safety. So I put myself into high speed away from the direction of all that unknown water life that didn't bother to introduce themselves as they got a taste of me going past. Initially, the water was completely stirred up so bad the light was useless. But after all the kicking I was doing and direction I was headed with the flippers on my feet, the lack of visibility was changing. Fortunately, after a couple of minutes, the water really got a lot clearer and no more silt to stir up. I finally got my heart rate slowed down a little, but my breathing needed some more time to adjust to the calmer surroundings. What seemed to be a good half hour from when I started the journey, I noticed what appeared to be a light at the end of the tunnel. Except this was literally a light. I could see the light. That meant I was near the surface and about at the end of the stellar experience. They had dropped a light down this tee I was to surface at. I'm very glad they did it. I had enough uncertainty to last me for a while. With the adrenaline rush starting to fall very quickly, I surfaced up the tube. For some strange reason, two guys saw me and grabbed both my arms and pulled me out immediately. I was very content with being removed from 20,000 leagues under the sea, or so it seemed, as I was feeling very lightheaded at that moment. They helped with removing my gear and sat me down on the floor. I do remember very clearly shouting for water. I need water. Or at least I thought I was shouting. In reality, it was much more like a whisper, according to them. A very bad case of cotton mouth and the need to resolve that condition as soon as possible. 2 bottles of water down, and I realized the guys had been asking about all the scratches covering a large part of my exposed parts. I looked down and noticed some scaly-looking chunks even slightly embedded in my skin, scuffed up and just barely catching under the surface. Not even enough to cause any bleeding, but they were definitely stuck to me, and a bunch stuck all over my shorts. Each one had to be pulled loose and felt like tearing my skin when peeling off. Some of these scales were nearly the size of a dime, almost clear and sticky, not slimy like I would have thought from a fish. I told everyone it had happened, and they just kind of blew me off. They figured I'd just panic and got caught up with a bunch of debris. They didn't really acknowledge my story and discounted the scales as anything unusual. To this day, I never found out what really took place. My tank got the same scrapes that were not caused from contact to the concrete. Those scratches were very obvious, too. These were in spots that could not hit anything without damage to other equipment, too. There is a first and last for many things in life. This was one that covered both of those times. Next story. The following story happened to one of my closest friends. It was told to me the next morning as he sat very upset and scared in his kitchen. This affected me deeply, as this friend is one of the most fearless and capable people I've ever met. Just to show you how calm and unexcitable he is, I will share one incident from his past. While sleeping in the back of his pickup truck one night in a very remote part of the southeast Idaho desert, he told me that he was startled out of a deep sleep by the uneasy feeling of being watched. Upon opening his eyes, he was surprised to see a gray, hairy man-like face leaning over the side of the pickup bed, watching him sleep. He quickly sat upright, startling the creature which he watched bound away in the moonlight through the sagebrush and lava rock. When he told me this, I asked, "What did you do?" He answered, "I went back to sleep. I was tired." As I said, not very excitable. So when I saw him that morning in his kitchen, scared and shaken, it affected me deeply. Here is what happened. My friend and I had just moved to Portland, Oregon after college. One day he asked me if he could borrow my .357 Magnum to take on a deer archery hunt he was planning the next weekend. He didn't think he would need to use it, but was concerned about the large bear population where he would be hunting. I loaned it to him. He arrived at the hunting site deep in the woods at the end of a logging road around twilight. Wanting to start hunting first thing the next morning, he rode his mountain bike in the dark to where he had hung his stand to spread some scent and make sure his shooting lanes were still open. As he was crouched down, dribbling dough and heat urine on a bush, he felt the presence of something behind him. He stood and turned, reaching for the only light he had brought with him, one of those little keyring LED lights that turn on when you squeeze it. He squeezed the light on and saw a pretty large set of eyes about 3 feet off the ground reflect back at him. The LED light was too weak to show anything else, just a reflection of those eyes. Thinking it was normal that a bear or deer would mistake him for an animal, after all he was crouched down and smelled like deer urine, he stood up Straight clapped his hand and said, "Get out of here," in a firm voice, expecting that the confused animal would bolt away when it realized he was human. His actions did not bring the expected result. Instead of turning and running away, the eye slowly rose to over 9 feet tall and took a step towards him. He felt an overwhelming sense of dread and quickly pulled the .357 out of the holster. Holding the revolver in one hand and the squeeze LED light in the other, he backed away from the eyes. Every step he took backwards, the eyes matched by advancing towards him, but always staying just out of the ring of light emitted by the key ring. In a short time, he was backed up against a large tree, which he used to protect his back while he watched the eyes observe him from 10 feet away. The eyes would weave back and forth like a large animal adjusting his weight from side to side. They would rise and lower slightly like something was studying him from different angles. Even though he never could actually see the animal, he had a sense of something huge. The way it moved, the sound of the leaves and dander under its feet as it walked, the impressive amounts of air that were inhaled and exhaled as it breathed, and most of all, the height of the eyes as they towered over him, all indicated a creature of massive proportions. After an eternity, he lost sight of the eyes, but he could hear the animal circling his position. More than an hour had passed since the last noise or sighting of the eyes. My friend, sitting with his back against a tree and a cocked .357 in his hand, decided it would be safe to leave the area. It was now around 1 o'clock in the morning. He started walking to where he left his mountain bike. To his dismay, he heard the animal paralleling him in the thick brush. The beast followed him to his bike, not wanting to lose his sense of hearing. His only warning of the animal's position, he chose to push his bike back to the truck instead of riding it. It took him over 4 hours to push the bike back to his camp. When he thought the animal was too close, judging by the sounds it made in the underbrush, he would stop and wait. Every time he stopped, the animal would inevitably start to circle him again. When it sounded like its route took it a little further away, my friend would start pushing his bicycle again, only to repeat the same routine every 10 minutes or so throughout the torturous night. Finally, after a lifetime, he reached his vehicle, and in an adrenaline and panic-induced sprint, he threw his bike in the back, started the truck, and was headed down the mountain. It took several miles before the heavy sense of doom started to recede. As the adrenaline wore off, the shake started. He started shaking so bad that it was all he could do to keep his truck on the road until he pulled up to his house and into a kitchen chair. That is where I found him. A while later, when I went over to his house to feed and water his dog. After he told me what happened to him, I offered to go back with him and retrieve his camping gear in Tristan. He refused the offer and left his possessions to nature rather than return to the area. Even though he hunts and fishes as avidly as ever, he will never go back to that spot and avoids the entire region passionately.